History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories right there, maybe down the street, maybe around the corner, perhaps even right next door. Stories most of us can't even really comprehend, but when we take the time to listen to them, we are really thankful we did. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we gain so much. We're educated, we're entertained. So often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. You might recall a couple months ago all the attention paid to the 75th anniversary, rightfully so, of the D-Day landings. Even here on Hometown Heroes, we went back in the archives to hear from so many veterans who had been a part of that massive operation. Come December, I'm sure you're going to be hearing a lot about the 75th anniversary of the Battle of the Bulge. And before that, you might even hear mention in the Netherlands of 75 years since Operation Market Garden. But one element of the war in Europe three quarters of a century ago that really ends up overlooked quite often will be the focus of our program today. It was initially planned to coincide with the Normandy landings, but didn't take place until August 1944. If you happened to be at the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. on August 15th, you would have caught a ceremony marking the 75th anniversary of the launch of Operation Dragoon, the invasion of southern France, carried out by many of the same men who had participated in Normandy, others who had endured fierce fighting in Italy, and many who would go on to experience those brutal conditions of the Battle of the Bulge. Approximately 200,000 Allied troops participated in Operation Dragoon, which was in its early stages of success 75 years ago this week. Some of those men have shared their stories here on Hometown Heroes over the years, and we're going to put them together into a bit of a mosaic for you today in honor of that 75th anniversary. By the end of this hour, we will have heard from five different veterans representing a combined five Purple Hearts. But we're going to start with a guy making his very first combat jump as a paratrooper at the start of that invasion. Walter Fees passed away in 2016, a couple years after this veteran of the 517th Parachute Infantry Regimental Combat Team shared with us his firsthand experience in Operation Dragoon.
We went in at night. We loaded up about 5, 6 o'clock in the evening. We went across the Caspian Sea over by Nice, France, and then 15 miles into France. And there's two ridges there going this way. And they're like, maybe 40, 50 miles across there. They were over 2,000 feet to go across these ridges. And then the planes were supposed to come in from the right like this and drop over and come down to 600 feet and jump us and then climb up and go out on the other side. But the Air Corps got scared. And when they come across those peaks, they just leveled off across there and jumped us more than 2,000 feet in the air. But before that, when we came in on the coast, man, that flak was something else. And I'm sitting there like this, and planes right over like this, about that far, and a big old piece of shrapnel comes through here, right out the other side. And I said, oh, Jesus, I'm going to get out of here.
So you're on a C-47?
C-47, yes, we had the one door.
So you're waiting in there to jump, and shrapnel comes within a foot or two of you?
Yeah, above my head here. I said, Jesus, I need to get out of here. And I could not wait. And I jumped, and I'm floating down there, and I look down there, and there's the fog below us. And it looked like when they invaded Sicily, they had dumped two plane loads of paratroopers into the ocean. And so I looked down there and saw that fog, and so I grabbed my T5 pack. You got a T5 pack here, and you turn it, open it, and it drops. And then you just put your arms straight down like this and hold yourself in the chute. And then when you get within 15, 20 feet of the water, you throw your arm straight up, and the chute goes off that way, and you go straight down. Because if you go straight down with that chute, it'll take you under, and you never get up. So I'm all ready to do that, and all of a sudden, I just sat down. I didn't even fall. I sat down in a plowed grape vineyard, where it was all plowed up in the middle, you know? Yeah. I just sat down on it and never even fell down. And so that's the kind of luck I had.
So you're expecting a splash that never came, huh?
Splash never came. So then Bob Rock was there. Me and Bob Rock, we were both big guys. Bob Rock was 6'2". They put me and him in the back of the stick. You know what a stick is. It's 16 men, and you go out the door. And they put me and Bob Rock back there. And whenever that green light come on, we just started going forward and pushing just as hard as we could because we wanted to get out fast. And so Bob Rock was riding back of me, and I get to looking around for him. I holler at Bob, where are you? And I'm up here on the hill. He's on the hill, you know. And
this is in the middle of the night. It's all dark.
Oh, yeah, sure. It's 5 minutes to five in the morning when we jumped. So Bob Rock's hollering. We're hollering back and forth. And all of a sudden, I hear shh, 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 going through the air. And I see these tracers going about 50 feet above us. And it's a German machine gun over there shooting at us, but he just didn't know what the hell he was doing. And so Bob come down off of there, and the side of his face was all bloody from hitting a tree and everything. And there, I hit that right in between the vineyard and never even fell down. So that's just the luck I had. I was lucky all the way.
And this is something that's always fascinated me with all the paratroopers I've spoken with, is jumping is nerve-wracking enough. Then you get on the ground. Yeah. And you got to figure out where in the world you are and where the enemy is.
Well, we had the compass. During training, they had taken us to Tennessee and dreamt us in the middle of Tennessee with nothing but our compasses on and a list of readings to go by. It was a three-day trick to get to Cookeville, Tennessee. And we were back out in those mountains, so we learned in the States how to do that. We know we wanted to go south to go straight to the ocean to meet those Germans coming up. See, with 15 miles in, that's what they do with the paratroopers. You jump way back there, and you form your line and everything. Then the ships come on the shore in the morning at day of the bridge break and start pushing them back. And then when the Germans come back over that hill, there we were waiting for them. The man, about noon, that big old cut over there, and a big old cut like this over there, looked over there, and that highway was just solid with trucks coming and looked like ants all over that hill where the Germans were coming. But just before that, Carl Salmon, our sniper, had went over there sniping them and everything, and about an hour later, the Jeep comes back with Carl laying on top of the hood with a bullet between his eyes. So, you know, just nothing, everything to shake you up. So here, we look over there, and all them Germans are coming. And then we look up above us, and there's these funny-looking planes circling over us. See, there was 5,000 of us, 5,000 British. These planes were circling over us, and so they're going to bomb us. Anyway, they circled over us, and here they went, over there bombing those Germans. And it was that British Mosquito Light bomber they had. And there were six of them, and they just bombed hell out of those guys over there. We're up on a hill covering a big grape vineyard, I mean like 2,000 acres or so. And all of a sudden, we looked out through there, and that whole grape vineyard was moving where the Germans were coming through it. And so we're laying up there. I'm popping my mortar right and left and everything. And then all of a sudden, vineyard just started disappearing from down at the other end all the way up through there. And it was the 442. Up above us, that Japanese American boys setting up there with their 4.2 mortars, and they just demolished that vineyard and all of them Germans in there. I went out through there, and there was over 200 of them dead in there, and it was those boys. So later on, whenever we left and went back, I go up through there, and there's the gliders that they came in on, and one of them was sitting like this up in the air, and there was 16 bodies laying under it with parachutes on them. Anybody got killed, you covered them with their parachute. There were 16 of them laying there under the edge of that glider. But the 442, they were something else.
Well, and we've spoken to some of those 442nd Regimental Combat Team vets on this program, the guys whose families, for the most part, were in internment camps, and here they are risking their lives and, in many cases, giving their lives overseas. It sounds like you're saying that you're not sure you'd be here without the 442nd.
No, we wouldn't have been, because they had sneaked in back there in them gliders. See, I came in the first wave, which is one reason why I'm still here. It was dark. And we landed for anybody could even see us and everything. And then the third and fourth wave of the paratroopers coming in, they got hell shot out of them. And then the gliders came in with them. When they jumped, they jump out, and the gliders are towing that back of them. They turn the gliders loose, and they come down. So they brought them 442 in by gliders. And I know they must have had high casualties, too. I got nothing but good to say about the 442. They're a fine group of young men, American men.
Amen. Well, and just hearing you describe all this, I can tell how real this all still is and how clear your memory is, and you're painting a powerful picture for the rest of us. So you'd been in Italy. Now here you are fighting the Germans in southern France. But you weren't quite done yet, huh?
No, we started back up through there, across the hills and into a valley over there, and and I go down by this house, and I'm setting up my motor there, and I look over on, across there about a mile, and there's a convoy of German trucks going up the other side of the river up through that little town. So I set up my motor, and I started blasting hell out of them trucks. And I look up, and here's six guys all dressed in black with armbands on, with dirty clothes on and everything, and carrying weapons on slings and everything, you know. And it was the Mach-E. They had been in there helping us, you know. And it was the Mach-E. They all came up and hugged us. That was nice.
Some people might not know what that means, what you're talking about.
Well, the Mach-E is the French resistance, and they were tough. They were tough boys. They hated the Germans so bad that it was far worse than we did, probably, because they had killed their women and everything, you know. They were just hugging us and everything. We give them grenades and all that kind of stuff.
So here you are. You're 20 years old. You fought your way through Italy and jumped behind enemy lines into southern France. And yet, now you look back and say, man, the Battle of the Bulge hadn't even happened yet.
Down there in southern France, we turned to the right, went up these hills, these twisted roads that the trucks had to pull forward and back up, go around the turn and everything, up to the top of the Alps Maritimes. And we tangled with the Germans up there. One morning, they took me down about 4 or 5 miles down this road and set me up on a little crossroads there and said, now there's about 50 Germans out there laying mines, and we got to stop them. And so my observer says, drop one in and go about 3,000 yards. So I dropped it in and went 3,000 yards. And he says, now bring it back about 150 yards and get it on this side. And then if they don't give up, you drop one in the middle. So I said, hell with this. I dropped it back 50 yards and dropped it in, and it was over. Killed three of them. The rest of them gave up, and they came up through there. And you would not believe that they were ragged, dirty kids about anywhere from 17 to 19 years old, maybe even 16, in the German army, forced in there, and they had them out there. Man, they were crying and everything else, scared the hell out of them. So, and then right after that, they brought us down off of that hill, and we got on the 40-8s and started towards Lille, France, for a 14-week vacation, which never materialized because of the Battle of the Bulge.
And not only would he end up in the Battle of the Bulge, he would have to survive 9 days being surrounded by German forces there. Since our focus today is the invasion of southern France and that 75th anniversary, we're not going to get into the rest of his experiences in the war today, but you can, of course, listen to that complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. There were some pretty close calls, of course, and like so many other veterans, the lingering effects of all those intense life-or-death moments were something he had to try to overcome.
One experience, me and my wife were sleeping in bed flat on our backs. She was beside me, and I wake up, and she's shaking me. She said, what the hell are you doing? And I was laying there fighting Germans on a dam, and my arm was coming up and down like this, hitting her, and she woke me up. So that's the way it was. You dreamt. For many months, you dreamt. Every night. Yeah, it doesn't go away that fast, you know?
I know it's not easy to talk about those things, but I think it's important for the rest of us to understand that this isn't something you left over there. It's something you've had to carry with you.
Yeah, for 2 or 3 years, maybe 3 or 4, maybe. And then I got busy working in the oil fields and raising kids, and you know, it just goes away slow.
And he was still working in the oil business when he shared his story here on the radio at age 90. That is the late Walter Fees from the 517th Parachute Infantry Regimental Combat Team, whose participation in the invasion of southern France 75 years ago came by jumping behind enemy lines. As for those who came ashore on the beaches of southern France, many have shared that that element of Operation Dragoon was a bit of a break compared to the other situations they've been through. The main invasion force was comprised of the 3rd Infantry Division, the 36th Infantry Division, and the 45th Infantry Division. Rex Rainey served with the 45th. And for a soldier that would end up in combat for more than 500 days, Operation Dragoon, on the heels of intense fighting in Italy, really did feel more comfortable by comparison.
From above Rome, then we went back to Naples and boarded ships and went to southern France for the invasion of southern France. That was the best one we had ever made.
The cleanest?
And we lost no men on it. We had lost one boat in Sicily. We didn't lose any at Salerno, but we went in and to an old farm kid, southern France was beautiful country.
I bet.
We didn't hit too much opposition for the most part, and so to speak, it was a paradise.
He even marked his 23rd birthday during the invasion of southern France, but some things he would witness a little later on were on the complete opposite end of the spectrum from paradise. And I think that's one thing that is really important to consider about the invasion of southern France. It progressed so rapidly and in concert with the forces that were continuing across the continent from Normandy. For example, Paris was liberated on August 29th, and that'll be the next 75th anniversary marked at the National World War II Memorial. But that pace really was important. Maybe it sounds a little obvious to say that every day the war was shortened meant lives were being saved. But Rex Rainey had a very compelling example of that when months later he ended up at the Dachau concentration camp in Germany.
There were bodies in stock cars and in gondolas and along the tracks and between them and hanging out of them. It's something you never expected to see. We didn't like what we saw. They had the crematorium, the big gas furnace going, and there was bodies piled up like cordwood that they had been, I guess, thrown in. We were about an hour after the camp was entered before we got in there. I don't think we had an hour before we was ready to go back.
Did you see any of the survivors of
the
camp?
Oh, yes. Yes, they would come and try to claw on you, get you to take them out. But they were walking skin and bones. I didn't see near all of them, but yes, I saw probably, I don't know, 50 or 100. Some of them were half in and half out of a train, couldn't move anymore. No, you can't imagine. I can't imagine what it was like, really. And I spent about an hour there.
Rex Rainey passed away last year at the age of 96, but his story bears witness to what it was that the Allied victory put a stop to. You can access his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com, and there's much more to come as we mark 75 years since the often overlooked but highly effective invasion of southern France. Still to come, the perspective of a glider pilot, a prisoner of war, and more. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.